and then the warm, dark water was pouring in around them. Locke felt a brief moment of genuine panic, hard not to when the knots binding hands and feet were very real, but after a few moments the edges of the net-backed sail began to draw upward again until they were just above the surface of the ocean. The water still trapped with the prisoners was about waist deep to Locke, and now the sail canvas formed a sort of shielded pool for them to stand and flounder about in.
"Everyone all right?"
That was Jean. Locke saw that he'd claimed the edge of the net directly across from him. There were half a dozen shoving, splashing men between them. Locke scowled at the realization that Jean was quite content to stay where he was.
"Fucking jolly,"
muttered Streber, holding himself upright by one arm. The other had been lashed to the front of his chest in a crude sling. Several of the ex-messengers were nursing broken bones, and nearly all of them had cuts and bruises, but not one had been excused from this ritual by his injuries.
"Your Honor!"
Locke glanced up at the sound of Del Mastro's voice. The lieutenant was peering down at them from the larboard entry port with a lantern in one hand. Their net was resting in the water 3 or 4 feet from the orchid's dark hull.
"Your Honor! They're not drowning!"
"What?"
Dracasha appeared next to Del Mastro with her false wig back on her head, now more wildly askew than ever.
"You rude little bastards! How dare you waste this court's time with this ridiculous refusal to be executed? Clark, help them drown!"
"Aye, ma'am! Immediate drowning assistance! Deck pumps at the ready! Deck pumps away!"
A pair of sailors appeared at the rail with the aperture of a canvas hose held between them. Locke turned away just as the gush of warm salt water started pounding down on them all. Not so bad, he thought, just seconds before something more substantial than water struck the back of his head with a wet, stinging smack. Bombardment with this new indignity, greased oakum, Locke quickly realized, was general and vigorous. Crewfolk had lined the rail and were flinging it down into the netted prisoners, a veritable rain of rags and rope fragments that had the familiar rancid stink of the stuff he'd spent several mornings painting the masts with. This assault continued for several minutes, until Locke had no idea where the grease ended and his clothes began, and the water in their little enclosure was topped with a sliding layer of foulness.
"Unbelievable!" shouted Del Mastro. "Your Honor! They're still there!"
"Not drowned?"
Zamira appeared at the rail once again and solemnly removed her wig.
"Damnation! The sea refuses to claim them! We shall have to bring them back aboard!"
After a few moments, the lines above them drew taut, and the little prison of net and canvas began to rise from the water. Not a moment too soon, it seemed. Locke shuddered as he felt something large and powerful brush against the barrier beneath his feet. In seconds, they were mercifully above the tips of the waves and creaking steadily upward. But their punishment was not yet over. They hung once more in the darkness when the net was hoisted above the rail and were not brought back in above the deck.
"Free the spinning tackle!" shouted Del Mastro.
Locke caught sight of a small woman shimmying out onto the tangle of ropes overhead. She pulled a restraining pin from the large wooden tackle by which the net was suspended. Locke recognized the circular metal bearing within the tackle. Heavily greased, it would allow even awkward and weighty cargoes to be spun with ease. Cargoes like them. Crewfolk lined the rail and began to grab at the net and heave it along. In moments the prisoners were spinning at a nauseating rate, and the world around them flew by in glimpses. Dark water, lamps on the deck, dark water, lamps on the deck.
"Oh, gods!"
said someone, a moment before he noisily threw up. There was a sudden scramble away from the poor fellow, and Locke clung grimly to his place at the edge of the net, trying to ignore the kicking, shuddering, spinning mass of men.
"Clean 'em up!" shouted Del Mastro. "Deck pumps away!"
The hard stream of salt water gushed into their midst once more, and they spun furiously. Locke intersected the spray every few seconds as each rotation of the net brought him around. His dizziness grew and grew as the minutes passed, and though it was becoming extremely fashionable, he focused every speck of dignity on simply not throwing up. So intense was his dizziness, and so swift was their deliverance, that he didn't even realize they'd been swung back onto the deck until the net he was clinging to collapsed into slackness. He toppled forward, onto netting and canvas above good, hard planks once again. The net had ceased spinning, but the world took its place, rotating in 6 or 7 directions at once, all of them profoundly unpleasant. Locke closed his eyes, but that didn't help. It merely made him blind as well as nauseous. Men were crawling over him, moaning and swearing. A pair of crew folk reached down and heaved Locke to his feet. His stomach nearly surrendered at that point, and he coughed sharply to fight back his nausea. Captain Drakasha was approaching, her false wig and cloak discarded, and she was tilted at a funny angle. "The sea won't have you," she said. "The water refuses to swallow you. It's not yet your time to drown, praise Yono. Praise Ulcris." Ulcris was the Jereshti name for the god of the sea, not often heard in Therin lands or waters. There must be more eastern islanders aboard than I realized, thought Locke. "Lord of the grasping waters, shield us," chanted the crew. "So you're here with us between all things," said Drakasha. "The land won't have you, and the sea won't claim you. You fled, like us, to wood and canvas. This deck's your firmament. These sails are your heavens. This is all the world you get. This is all the world you need." She stepped forward with a drawn dagger. "Will you lick my boots to claim a place on it?" "No!" the ex-messengers roared in unison. They'd been coached on this part of the ritual. "Will you kneel and kiss my jeweled ring for mercy?" "No!" "Will you bend your knees to pretty titles on pieces of paper?" "No!" "Will you pine for land and laws and kings and cling to them like a mother's tit?" "No!" She stepped up to Locke and handed him the dagger. "Then free yourself, brother." Still unsteady and grateful for the aid of the crew folk beside him, Locke used the blade to saw through the rope that bound his hands, and then bent over to cut the rope between his ankles. That accomplished, he turned and saw that all of the ex-messengers were more or less upright, most of them held by 1 or 2 orchids. Close at hand, he could see several familiar faces. Streva, Jabril, a fellow called Alvaro, and just behind them, Jean, watching him uneasily. Locke hesitated, then pointed to Jabril and held out the blade. "Free yourself, brother!" Jabril smiled, took the blade, and was finished with his bonds in a moment. Jean glared at him. Locke closed his eyes, not wanting to make further eye contact, and listened as the dagger made its passage through the group, from hand to hand. "Free yourself, brother," they murmured, one after another, and then it was done. "Unbound by your own hands, you are outlaw brethren of the Sea of Brass," said Captain Drakasha, "and crewmen of the Poison Orchid." 2. Even an experienced thief will find occasion to learn new tricks if he lives long enough. That morning and afternoon, Locke had learned how to properly loot a captured ship. Locke finished his last circuit below decks, reasonably certain there were no more Kingfisher crew folk to round up, and stomped up the companionway to the quarterdeck. The bodies of the Redeemers there had been moved aside and stacked at the taffrail. The bodies of those from the Poison Orchid had been carried down to the waist. Locke could see several of Zamira's crewfolk respectfully covering them with sail canvas. He quickly surveyed the ship. 30 or 40 orchids had come aboard and were taking control of the vessel everywhere. They were up the ratlines, with Jean Del Mastro at the wheel, tending the anchors and guarding the 30 or so surviving Kingfisher crewfolk atop the forecastle deck. Under Utgar's supervision, the wounded kingfishers and orchids had been carried down to the waist near the starboard entry port, where Captain Drakasha and Scholar Tregan were just coming aboard. Locke hurried toward them.
"It's my arm, Scholar. Hurts something awful."
Strever used his good arm to support his injured limb as he winced and held it out for Tregann's inspection.
"I think it's broken." "Of course it's broken, you cretinous turd," she said, brushing past him to kneel beside a kingfisher whose tunic was completely soaked in blood. "Keep waving it like that and it'll snap right off. Sit down." "But I work from worst chance to best," Tregann muttered.
She knelt on the deck beside the injured kingfisher, using her cane to brace herself until she was on both knees. Then she gave the cane a twist. The handle separated from the cane's full length, revealing a dagger-sized blade that Tregann used to slice the sailor's tunic open.
"I can move you up on my list by kicking your head a couple of times. Still want prompt attention?"
No.
"You'll keep. Piss off."
"There you are, Ravel."
Captain Drakasha stepped past Tregann and the injured and grabbed Locke by the shoulder.
"You've done well for yourself."
"Have I?"
"You're as useless as an ass without a haul when it comes to running a ship, but I've heard the damnedest things about how you fought just now."
"Your sources exaggerate."
"Well, the ship's ours and you gave us her master. Now that we've plucked our flower, we need to sip the nectar before bad weather or another ship comes along."
"Will you be taking the kingfisher as a prize?"
"No. I don't like having more than one prize crew out at a time. We'll shake her down for valuables and useful cargo."
"Then burn her or something?"
"Of course not. We'll leave the crew stores enough to make port and watch them scamper for the horizon." "You look confused."
"No objections, Captain. It's just not as downright bastardly as I was expecting."
"You don't think we respect surrenders because we're kindly people, do you, Ravel?"
Drakasha grinned.
"I don't have much time to explain, but it's like this. If not for those gods-damned redeemers, these people..."
She waved a hand at the injured kingfishers waiting for Dragan's attention.
"Wouldn't have given or taken a scratch. 4 out of 5 ships we take, I'd say. If they can't rig razor nets and get bows ready, they just roll right over for it. They know we'll let them slip off with their lives once we're done. And the common sailors don't own 1 centira of the cargo, so why should they swallow a blade or a crossbow bolt for it?"
"I guess it does make sense."
"To more people than us. Look at this shambles. Redeemers for security? If those maniacs hadn't been available for free, this ship wouldn't have any real guards. I guarantee it. No sense in it for the owners. These long voyages, 4 or 5 months from the Far East back to Talvara with spices, rare metals, wood. An owner can lose 2 ships out of 3, and the one that arrives will pay for the 2 that don't, with profit to spare. And if they get the actual ship back, even sans cargo, so much the better. That's why we don't sink and burn like mad. As long as we show some restraint and don't get too close to civilization, the folks holding the purse strings think of us as a natural hazard, like the weather."
"So with the, plucking and sipping the nectar bit, where do we start?"
"Most worthwhile thing at hand is the ship's purse," said Drakasha. "Master keeps it for expenses, bribes, and so forth. Finding it's always a pain in the ass. Some throw it overboard, others hide it somewhere dank and unlikely. We'll probably have to slap this Nera around for a few hours before he spits truth."
"Damnation!"
Behind them, Tregann let her patience slump to the deck and began wiping her bloody hands on his breeches.
"No good on this one, Captain. I can see straight through to his lungs behind the wound."
"He's dead for sure," said Locke.
"Well, heavens, I wouldn't know. I'm just the fucking physicker. But I heard in a bar once that dead is the accepted thing to be when your lungs are open to daylight," said Tregann.
Yes, I heard the same thing. Look, will anyone else here die without your immediate full attention?"
"Not likely."
"Captain Drakasha," said Locke,
Master Nera has something of a soft heart. Might I take the liberty of suggesting a plan? A few moments later, Locke returned to the waist, holding Antoro Nera by one arm. The man's hands had been bound behind his back. Locke gave him a good shove towards Amira, who stood with one sabre unsheathed. Behind her, Tregan worked feverishly over the corpse of the newly deceased sailor. The slashed and bloody tunic had been disposed of, and a clean one drawn over the corpse's chest. Only a small red spot now marked the lethal wound, and Tregan gave every impression that the unmoving form was still within her power to save. Drakasha caught Nera and set her blade against his upper chest.
"Please to make your acquaintance," she said, sliding the curved edge of her weapon toward Nera's unprotected neck. He whimpered. "Your ship's badly out of trim. Too much weight of gold. We need to find and remove the master's purse as quick as we can."
"I, don't know exactly where it is," said Nera.
"Right, and I can teach fish to fart fire," said Drakasha. "You get one more chance, and then I start throwing your injured overboard."
"But, please, I was told..."
"Whoever told you anything wasn't me."
I don't..."
"Scholar," said Drakasha, "can you do anything for the man you're working on?"
"He won't be dancing any time soon," said Tregan. "But yes, he'll pull through."
Drakasha shifted her grip on Nera and held him by his tunic collar with her free hand. She took two steps to her right and, barely looking, drove her sabre down into the dead sailor's neck. Tregan flinched backward and gave the corpse's legs a little push to make it look as though they'd kicked. Nera gasped.
"Medicine is such an uncertain business," said Drakasha.
"In my cabin," said Nera. "A hidden compartment by the compass above my bed. Please, please don't kill any more of..."
"I didn't, actually," said Drakasha.
She withdrew her sabre from the corpse's throat, wiped it on Nera's breeches, and gave him a quick kiss on the cheek.
"Your man died a few minutes ago. My leech says she can save the rest of you injured without trouble."
She spun Nera around, slashed the rope that bound his hands, and shoved him toward Locke with a grin.
"Return him to his people, Ravel, and then kindly relieve his secret compartment of its burden."
"Your will, Captain."
After that, they began taking the kingfisher apart more eagerly than newlyweds tearing off layers of formal clothing in their first moment of privacy. Locke felt his fatigue vanishing as he became absorbed in what was essentially one vast robbery for more physical material than he'd ever stolen before in his life. He was passed from duty to duty among orchids who laughed and clowned with real spirit, but worked with haste and precision for all that. First they snatched up anything portable and reasonably valuable. Bottles of wine, Master Nera's formal wardrobe, bags of coffee and tea from the galley, and several crossbows from the kingfisher's tiny armory. Drakasha herself appraised the ship's collection of navigational instruments and hourglasses, leaving Nera the bare minimum required to safely work his vessel back to port. Next, Utgar and the bosun scoured the flute from stem to stern, using the surviving scrub watch as mules to haul off stores and equipment of nautical use, alchemical cork, good sail canvas, carpenter's tools, barrels of pitch, and loop after loop of new rope.
"Good shit, hey!"
said Utgar, as he weighed Locke down with about 50 pounds of rope and a box of metal files.
"Much too expensive in Port Prodigal. Always best to get it at what we call the broadside discount."
Last but not least came the Kingfisher's cargo. All the main deck hatch gratings were pulled, and a nearly incomprehensible network of ropes and pulleys was rigged on and between the two ships. By noon, crates and casks and oilcloth-wrapped bundles were being lighted along to the poison orchid. It was everything Nera had promised and more. Turpentine, oiled witchwood, silks, crates of fine yellow wine padded with sheepskins, and barrel after barrel of bulk spices. The smell of cloves, nutmeg, and ginger filled the air. After an hour or two of work at the hoists, Locke was brown with a sludge that was half sweat and half powdered cinnamon. At the fifth hour of the afternoon, Drakasha called a halt to the forcible transfusion of wealth. The poison orchid rode lower in the gleaming water, and the lightened flute rolled freely, hollowed out like an insect husk about to fall from a spider's jaws. Drakasha's crew hadn't stripped her clean, of course. They left the kingfishers their casks of water, salted meat, cheap ale, and pink piss ration wine. They even left a few crates and parcels of valuables that were too deeply or inconveniently stowed for Drakasha's taste. Nonetheless, the sack was thorough. Any land-bound merchant would have been well pleased to have a ship unloaded at the dock with such haste. A brief ceremony was held at the taffrail of the Kingfisher. Zamira blessed the dead of the two vessels in her capacity as a lay priestess of Yono. Then the corpses went over the side, sewn into old canvas with Redeemer weapons weighing them down. The Redeemers themselves were then thrown overboard without a word.
"Ain't disrespectful,"
said Utgar when Locke whispered to him about this.
"Far as they believe, they get consecrated and blessed and all that fine stuff by their own gods the moment they die. No hard feelings if you just tip the heathens over the side afterward. Helpful thing to know if you ever have to kill a bunch of 'em again, eh?"
At last the day's long business was truly concluded. Master Nera and his crew were released to tend to their own fortunes once again. While Drakasha's archers kept watch from their perches on the yardarms, the network of lines and fend-offs between the two ships was pulled apart. The poison orchid hauled up her boats and loosed her sails. In minutes she was making 7 or 8 knots to the southwest, leaving the Kingfisher adrift in disarray behind her. Locke had seen little of Jean all day, and both of them had seemed to work to studiously preserve their separation. Just as Locke had thrown himself into manual labor, Jean had remained with Delmastro on the quarterdeck. They didn't come close enough to speak again until the sun fell beneath the horizon, and the scrub watch was herded together and bound for their initiation. 3. All the new initiates and half the ship's old company were on the merry watch, fueled by rack after rack of the fine eastern wines they'd plucked from the Kingfisher. Locke recognized some of the labels and vintages. Stuff that wouldn't sell in Camor for less than 20 crowns a bottle was being sucked down like beer, or poured into the hair of celebrating men and women, or simply spilled on deck. The orchids, men and women alike, were mixing eagerly with the ex-messengers now. Dice games and wrestling matches and song circles had erupted spontaneously. Propositions spoken and unspoken were everywhere. Jabril had vanished below decks with a crew woman at least an hour before. Locke took it all in from the shadows of the starboard side, just below the raised quarterdeck. The starboard stairs weren't flush with the rail. There was space enough for a lean person to wedge comfortably between the two. Ravel had been greeted warmly and eagerly enough when he'd circulated on deck, but now that he'd found a cozy exile, nobody seemed to be missing him. In his hands was a large leather jack full of blue wine that was worth its weight in silver, untouched. Across the great mass of laughing, drinking sailors, Locke could make out Jean at the ship's opposite rail. While Locke watched, the shape of a woman, much shorter, approached him from behind and reached out toward him. Locke turned away. The water slipped past, a black gel topped with curls of faintly phosphorescent foam. The orchid was setting a good pace through the night. Laden, she yielded less than before to the chop of the sea, and was parting these little waves like they were air. "When I was a lieutenant apprentice," said Captain Drakasha, "on my first voyage with an officer's sword, I lied to my captain about stealing a bottle of wine." She spoke softly. Startled, Locke looked around and saw that she was standing directly over him at the forward quarterdeck rail. "Not just me," she continued, "all 8 of us in the apprentice's berth. We borrowed it from the captain's private stores, and should have been smart enough to pitch it over the side when we'd finished." "In the
Navy of Cyrun, this was?
Her resplendent majesty's sea forces of Cyrun eternal.
Drakash's smile was a crescent of white against darkness, faint as the foam topping the waves.
The captain could have had us whipped, or reduced in rank, or even chained up for formal trial on land. Instead, she had us strike down the royal yard from the mainmast. We had a spare, of course, but she made us scrape the varnish off the one we'd taken down. This is a spar of oak, you know, 10 feet long and thick as a leg. The captain took our swords and said they'd be restored if, and only if, we ate the royal yard. Tip to tip, every last splinter.
Ate it?
1.25 feet of sturdy oak for each of us, said Drakasha. How we did it was our business. It took a month. We tried everything, shaving it, scraping it, boiling it, pulping it. We had 100 tricks to make it palatable, and we forced it down, 1 few spoonfuls or chips a day. Most of us got sick, but we ate the yard.
Gods!
When it was over, the captain said she'd wanted us to understand that lies between shipmates tear the ship apart, bit by bit, gnawing at it just as we'd gnawed the royal yard down to nothing.
Ah!
Locke sighed and at last took a sip of his warm, excellent wine. I take it this means I'm due for a bit more dissection, then?
Come join me at the taffrail.
Locke rose, knowing it wasn't a request.
4. I never knew that dispensing justice could be so tiring, said Esri, appearing at Jean's right elbow as he stood staring out over the orchid's larboard rail.
One of the moons was just starting to rise in the south, half a silver-white coin peeking above the night horizon, as though lazily considering whether it was worth rising at all.
You've had a long day, Lieutenant. Jean smiled.
Jerome, she said, reaching out to set a hand upon his right forearm, if you call me Lieutenant again tonight, I'll kill you.
As you wish, Lou.
La, something or other, Lieutenant that starts with Lou.
Honest.
Besides, you already tried to execute me once this evening. Look how that turned out.
Best way possible, she said, now leaning against the rail beside him.
She wasn't wearing her armour, just a thin tunic and a pair of calf-length breeches without hose or shoes. Her hair was free, waves of dark curls rustling in the breeze. Jean realized that she was putting most of her weight against the rail and trying hard not to show it.
You got a little too close to a few blades today, he said.
I've been closer. But you, now, you're a very good fighter, do you know that?
It's been s-
Gods, how wretched was that? Of course you're a good fighter. I meant to say something much wittier, honest.
Then consider it said. Jean scratched his beard and felt a warm, welcome sort of nervousness fluttering in his stomach.
We can both pretend. All of the, effortlessly witty nonsense I've been practicing on the barrels in the hold for days has taken flight, too.
Practicing, hmm?
Yeah, well, that Jabril, he's a sophisticated fellow, isn't he? Need a bit of conversation to catch his attention, won't I?
What?
Didn't you know I only fancied men, tall men?
Ooh, I kicked you to the deck once, Valora, and I'm about to...
Ah, in your condition?
My condition is the only thing saving your life at the moment.
You wouldn't dare heap abuse on me in front of half the crew.
Of course I would.
Well, yes, true.
Look at this lovely, noisy mess. I don't think anyone would even notice if I set you on fire. Hell, down in the main deck hold, there's couples going at it packed tighter than spears in the arms lockers. You want real peace and quiet any time tonight. Closest place you might find it is 200 or 300 yards off one of the bows.
No, thanks. I don't know how to say stop eating me in shark.
Well, then, you're stuck here with us. And we've been waiting for you lot to get off the scrub watch for long enough.
She grinned up at him. Tonight, everyone gets to know everyone else. Jean stared at her, eyes wide, not knowing what to say or do next. Her grin became a frown.
Jerome, am I doing something wrong?
Wrong?
You keep sort of moving away, not just with your body, but with your neck. You keep...
Oh, hell. Jean laughed, reached out to put a hand on her shoulder, and felt himself burst into an uncontrollable twit grin when she reached up to hold it there. Ezri, I lost my optics when you made a swim the day we came aboard. I'm what they call near blind. I guess I didn't realize it, but I've been fidgeting to keep you in focus.
Oh, God, she whispered. I'm sorry.
Don't be. Keeping you in focus is worth the trouble.
I didn't mean...
I know. Jean felt the anxious pressure in his stomach migrating upward to fill his chest, and he took a deep breath. Look, we almost got killed today. Fuck these games. Do you want to have a drink with me? 5.
Watch, said Drakasha.
Locke stood at the taffrail, looking down into the ship's phosphorescent wake between the glow of 2 stern lanterns. Those lanterns were glowing glass orchids the size of his head, transparent petals drooping delicately toward the water.
Gods,
said Locke, shuddering. Between the wake and the lanterns, there was just enough light for him to spot it, a long black shadow sliding beneath the poison orchid's trail of disturbed water. 40 or 50 feet of something sinuous and sinister, using the ship's wake to conceal itself. Captain Drakasha had one boot up on the taffrail and an expression of casual pleasure on her face.
What the hell is it?
5 or 6 possibilities, said Drakasha. Might be a whale worm or a giant devilfish.
Is it following us?
Yes.
Is it, dangerous?
Well, if you drop your drink over the rail, don't jump in after it.
Don't you think you should maybe let it have a few arrows?
I might, if only I were sure that this was the fastest it could swim.
Good point.
Fling arrows at all the strange things you see out here, Ravel, and all you do is run out of arrows.
She sighed and glanced around to ensure that they were more or less alone. The closest crewman was at the wheel, 8 or 9 yards forward.
You made yourself very useful today.
Well, the alternative just didn't suit.
I thought I was abetting a suicide when I agreed to let you lead the boats.
You nearly were, Captain. It was... Look, it was inches from disaster the whole way, that fight. I don't even remember half of it. The gods blessed me by allowing me to avoid soiling my breeches. Surely you know what it's like.
I do. I also know that sometimes these things aren't accidents. You and Master Valora have excited a great deal of comment for what you did in that battle. Your skills are unusual for a former master of weights and measures.
Weighing and measuring is a boring occupation, said Locke. A man needs a hobby.
The Archon's people didn't hire you by accident, did they?
What?
I said I'd peel this strange fruit you call a story, Ravel, and I have been. My initial impression of you wasn't favorable, but you've done better. And I think I can understand how you kept your old crew in thrall despite your ignorance. You seem to have a real talent for improvised dishonesty.
Weighing and measuring is a very, very boring...
So, you're a master of a sedentary occupation who just happened to have a talent for espionage and disguise and command, not to mention your skill at arms or that of your close and unusually educated friend Jerome.
Our mothers were so very proud of us. "You weren't hired away from the Priory by the Archon," said Drakasha. "You were double agents, planted provocateurs, intended to enter the Archon's service. You didn't steal that ship because of some insult you won't speak of. You stole it because your orders were to damage the Archon's credibility, to do something big."
Please, Ravel, as if there could be any other reasonable explanation.
Gods, what a temptation, Locke thought. A mark actually inviting me to step into her own misconception, free and clear. He stared at the phosphorescent wake, at the mysterious something swimming beneath it. What to do? Take the opening, cement the Ravel and Valora identities in Drakasha's mind, work from there? Or, his cheeks burned as the sting of Jean's rebuke rose again in his memory. Jean hadn't just criticized him on theological grounds, or because of Del Mastro. It was a matter of approaches. Which would be more effective? Treat this woman as a mark, or treat her as an ally? Time was running out. This conversation was the point of decision. Follow his instincts and play her, or follow Jean's advice and attempt to trust her? He thought furiously. His own instincts, were they always impeccable? Jean's instincts, arguments aside, had Jean ever done anything but try to protect him? "Tell me something," he said very slowly, "while I weigh a response. Perhaps something half the size of this ship is probably staring at us as we speak."
"Yes.
How do you stand it?"
"You see things like this often enough, you get used."
"Not just that. Everything. I've been at sea a grand total of 6 or 7 weeks in my life. How long have you been out here?" She stared at him, saying nothing.
"Some things about myself," said Locke, "I won't tell you just because you're the captain of this ship, even if you throw me back in the hold or pitch me over the side. Some things, I want to know who I'm talking to first. I want to talk to Zamira, not to Captain Drakasha." Still she remained silent.
"Is that asking so very much?"
"I'm 39, she said at last, very quietly. "I first sailed when I was 11.
"Nearly 30 years, then. "Well, like I said, I've been out here a few weeks, and in that time, storms, mutiny, seasickness, battles, flit-wraiths, hungry damn things lurking all over the place, waiting for someone to dip a toe in the water. It's not that I haven't enjoyed myself at times. I have. I've learned things. But 30 years? And children as well? Don't you find it all chancy?"
"Do you have children, Orin?"
"No." "The instant I decide that you are presuming to lecture me on their behalf, this conversation will end with you going over this rail to make the acquaintance of whatever's down there."
"That's not at all what I meant. It's just..."
"Have people on land acquired the secret of living forever? Have they abolished accidents? Have they ceased to have weather in my absence?"
"Of course not."
"How much more danger are my children truly in than some poor bastard conscripted to fight in his duke's wars? Or some penniless family dying of a plague with their neighborhood quarantined or burnt to the ground? Wars, disease, taxes, bowing heads and kissing boots. There's plenty of hungry damn things prowling on land, Orin. It's just that the ones at sea tend not to wear crowns."
"Ah. Was your life a paradise before you sailed the Sea of Brass?"
"No."
"Of course not. Listen well. I thought that I'd grown up in a hierarchy where mere competence and loyalty were enough to maintain one's station in life," she whispered. "I gave an oath of service and imagined that oath was binding in both directions. I was a fool, and I had to kill an awful lot of men and women to escape the consequences of that foolishness. Would you really ask me to place my trust and my hopes for Paolo and Cosetta in the same bullshit that nearly killed me before? Which system of laws should I bend to, Orin? Which king or duke or empress should I trust like a mother? Which of them is a better judge of my life's worth than I am? Can you point them out to me? Write a letter of introduction?
Samira, said Locke, please don't make me out to be some sort of advocate for things that I'm not. It seems to me that my whole life has been spent in the willful disdain of what you're talking about. Do I strike you as a law and order sort of fellow?
Admittedly not. I'm just curious is all. I do appreciate this. Tell me now, what about the Free Armada, your so-called war for recognition? Why profess such hatred for laws and taxes and all those strictures if that was essentially what you were fighting to emplace down here?
Ah, Zamira sighed, removed her four-cornered hat, and ran her fingers through her breeze-tossed hair.
Our infamous lost cause, our personal contribution to the glorious history of Tal Vahrah.
Why did you start it?
Bad judgment. We all hoped, well, Captain Bonaire was persuasive. We had a leader, a plan, open mines on new islands, tap some of the safe forests for wood and resin, pillage as we liked until the other powers on the Sea of Brass came wringing their hands to the bargaining table, and then beat the shit out of them with authorized trade. We imagined a realm without tariffs, Montier and Port Prodigal swelling up with merchants and their imported fortunes.
Ambitious.
Idiotic. I was newly escaped from one sour allegiance and I leapt right into another. We believed Bonaire when she said that Stragos didn't have the clout to come down and mount a serious fight.
Oh, hell.
They met us at sea. Biggest action I ever saw, and the soonest lost. Stragos put hundreds of Ferrari soldiers on his ships to back the sailors. We never stood a chance in close action. Once they had the basilisk, they stopped taking prisoners. They'd board a ship, scuttle it, and move on to the next. Their archers put shafts into anyone in the water, at least until the devilfish came. I needed every trick I had just to get the orchid out. A few of us straggled back to Prodigal, beat to hell, and even before we got there, the Ferrari pounded Montier into the sand. 500 dead in one morning. After that, they sailed back home, and I imagine there was a lot of dancing, fucking, and speeches.
I think, said Locke, you can take a city like Tal Vahrah, and you can threaten its purse strings or its pride, and get away with it, but not if you threaten both at once.
You're right. Maybe Stragos was impotent when Bonaire left the city. Whatever he was, we united Tal Vahrah's interests behind him. We summoned him up like some demon out of a story.
She folded her arms over her hat and leaned forward, resting her elbows against the taffrail.
So we stayed outlaws. No flowering of the ghost winds, no glorious destiny for Port Prodigal. This ship is our world now, and I only take her in when her belly's too full to prowl. Am I making myself clear, Orin? I don't regret how I've lived these past few years. I move where I will. I set no appointments, I guard no borders. What land-bound king has the freedom of a ship's captain? The Sea of Brass provides. When I need haste, it gives me winds. When I need gold, it gives me galleons.
Thieves prosper, thought Locke. The rich remember. He made his decision and gripped the rail to avoid shaking.
Only God's damned fools die for lines drawn on maps, said Zamira. But nobody can draw lines around my ship. If they try, all I need to do to slip away is set more sail.
Yeah, said Locke. But, Zamira, what if I were forced to tell you that that may no longer be the case?
6. Have you really been practicing on barrels, Jerome?
They'd laid claim to a bottle of black pomegranate brandy from one of the crates broken open amidst the revellers, and taken it back to their spot by the rail.
Barrels, yes.
Jean took a sip of the stuff, dark as distilled night, with a sting like nettles beneath the sweetness. He passed the bottle back to her.
They never laugh, they never ridicule you, and they offer no distractions.
Distractions?
Barrels don't have breasts.
Ah, so what have you been telling these barrels?
This bottle of brandy, said Jean, is still too full for me to begin embarrassing myself like that.
Pretend I'm a barrel, then.
Barrels don't have
So I've heard. Find the nerve, Valora.
You want me to pretend that you're a barrel, so I can tell you what I was telling barrels back when I was pretending they were you.
Precisely.
Well, he took another long sip from the brandy bottle. You have such hoops as I have never seen in any cask on any ship. Such shiny and well-fit hoops.
Jerome!
And your staves!
He decided it was a good time to take another drink.
Your staves! So well-planed, so tightly fit. You are as fine a cask as I have ever seen, you marvellous little barrel. To say nothing of your bung.
Ahem! So you won't share your sweet nothings?
No, I am utterly emboldened in my cowardice.
Man, what a mouse he is made by conversation,
Esri recited.
Scorns gods, dares battle, and flinches from a maid's rebuke. Merest laugh from merest girl is like a dagger felt, and like a dagger makes a lodging of his breast. Turns blood to milk water and courage to faint memory.
Oh, Lucano, is it?
Jean tugged at his beard thoughtfully.
Woman, your heart is a mapless maze. Could I bottle confusion and drink it 1,000 years, I could not confound myself so much as you do between waking and breakfast. You are grown so devious that serpents would applaud your passage, would the gods but give them hands.
I like that one, she said. The Empire of 7 days, right?
Right. Esri, forgive my asking, but how the hell do you...
It's no more odd than the fact that you know any of this.
She took the bottle from him, tipped it back for a long draught, and then raised her free hand.
I know. I'll give you a hint. I have held the world from meridian to meridian, in my hands and at my whim. I have received the confessions of emperors, the wisdom of magi, the lamentations of generals.
You had a library? You have a library?
Had, she said. I was the 6th of 6 daughters. I imagine the novelty wore off. Mother and father could afford live companions for the older 5. I made do with all the dead playmates in mother's books.
With her next drink she drained the last of the bottle, and with a grin she tossed it overboard.
So what's your excuse?
My education was, eclectic.
Did you ever... When you were little, do you remember a toy of wooden pegs in various shapes that would fit into matching holes on a wooden frame?
Yes, she said. I got my sisters when they tired of it.
You might say that I was trained to be a professional square peg in a round hole.
Really? Is there a guild for that?
We've been working on getting a charter for years.
Did you have a library as well?
After a fashion. Sometimes we'd borrow someone else's without their knowledge or cooperation. Long story. But there's one other reason. I'll give you a verse of your own to guess. After dark, he recited with a flourish, an ass with an audience of 1 is called a husband. An ass with an audience of 200 is called a success.
You were on stage,
she said. You were a player, professionally?
Temporarily, said Jean. Very temporarily. I was, well, we...
He glanced aft and instantly regretted it. Ravel, Ezri said, then looked at Jean curiously. You and he were... You two are having some sort of disagreement, aren't you?
Can we not talk about him?
Jean, feeling bold and nervous at once, put a hand on her arm.
Just for tonight. Can he not exist?
We can indeed not talk about him, she said, shifting herself so that her weight rested against his chest rather than the rail. Tonight, she said, nobody else exists. Jean stared down at her, suddenly acutely aware of the beat of his own heart. The rising moonlight in her eyes, the feel of her warmth against him, the smell of brandy and sweat and salt water that was uniquely hers, suddenly the only thing he was capable of saying was,
Jerome Valora, she said, you magnificent idiot, must I draw you a diagram?
Of?
Take me to my cabin.
She curled the fabric of his tunic in one fist.
I have the privilege of walls, and I intend to use it. At length.
Ezri, Jean whispered, never in 100, never in 1,000 years would I say no. But you were cut half to ribbons today, and you can barely stand.
I know, she said. That's the only reason I'm confident I'm not going to break you.
Oh, for that I'm going to...
I certainly hope you will.
She threw her arms wide.
First, get me there.
He picked her up with ease. She settled into his arms and wrapped hers around his neck. As Jean swung away from the rail and headed for the quarterdeck stairs, he found himself facing an arc of 30 or 40 merry watch revelers. They raised their arms and began cheering wildly.
"Put your names on a list," hollered Ezri, "so I can kill you all in the morning."
She smiled and turned her eyes back to Jean.
"Or maybe it'll have to wait for the afternoon."
7. "Just listen," said Locke. "Listen, please, with as open a mind as you can manage."
"I'll do my best."
Deduction about Jerome and myself is commendable. It does make sense, but for the parts that I've concealed until now. Starting with myself, I'm not a trained fighter. I'm a bloody miserable fighter. I have tried to be otherwise, but the gods know it's always comedy or tragedy before I can blink.
That...
Zamira, heed this. I didn't kill 4 men with anything resembling skill. I dropped a beer cask on a man too dumb to look up. I slit the throats of 2 more who got knocked aside by the cask. I did the 4th when he slipped in beer. When everyone else found the bodies, I let them make their own assumptions.
But I know for a fact that you charged those redeemers all by yourself.
Yes, people who are about to die frequently go out of their minds. I should have died 10 seconds into that fight, Zamira. It was Jerome who made it otherwise. Jerome and only Jerome. At that moment, a loud cheer abruptly rose above the noise of the near carnival at the ship's waist. Locke and Zamira both turned in time to see Jean appear at the top of the quarterdeck stairs with Lieutenant Del Mastro in his arms. Neither of them so much as glanced aft at Locke and the captain. A few seconds later, they were vanishing down the companionway.
Well, said Zamira, to win that heart, even for a night, your friend Jerome must be even more extraordinary than I thought.
He is extraordinary, Locke whispered. He continues to save my life time and time again, even when I don't deserve it.
He returned his gaze to the orchid's roiling, glowing, monster-haunted wake,
which is always more or less...
Zamira said nothing, and after a few moments, Locke continued. Well, after he did it again this morning,
I slipped and fumbled and ran like hell until the fight was over. That's all. Panic and dumb luck.
You still led the boats. You still went up first, not knowing what was waiting for you.
All bullshit. I'm a bullshit artist, Samira. A false facer, an actor, an impersonator. I didn't have any noble motives when I made that request. My life just wasn't worth much if I didn't do something utterly crazy to win back some respect. I faked every second of composure anyone glimpsed this morning.
The fact that you consider that extraordinary only tells me that it really was your first actual battle.
But, Ravel, anyone in command feigns ease when death is near. We do it for those around us, and we do it for ourselves. We do it because the sole alternative is to die cringing. The difference between an experienced leader and an untested one is that only the untested one is shocked at how well they can pretend when their hand is forced.
I don't believe this, said Locke. When I first came aboard, I couldn't impress you enough to make you spit in my face. Now you're making my excuses for me. Samira, Jerome, and I never worked for the Priori. I've never even met a Priori except in passing. The fact is that we're still working for Maxilan Stragos as we speak.
What?
Jerome and I are thieves. Professional, independent thieves. We came to Tal Varar on a very delicate job of our own design. The Archon's intelligence services figured out who and what we were. Stragos poisoned us, a latent poison for which only he can supply the antidote. Until we get it or secure some other remedy, we're his puppets.
To what possible end?
Stragos handed us the Red Messenger, allowed us to take a crew from Windward Rock, and built up a parchment trail concerning an imaginary disgruntled officer named Orin Ravel. He gave us our sailing master, the one whose heart seized on us before we hit the storm, and sent us out here on his business. That's how we got the ship. That's how we tweaked Stragos' nose in such an unlikely fashion. All was to his design.
What's he after? Someone in Port Prodigal?
He wants the same thing you gave him last time you crossed paths. He's all but at war with the Priori, and he's feeling his years. If he's going to seize anything resembling popularity ever again, the time is now. He needs an enemy outside the city to bring his army and navy back into favor. That's you, Samira. Nothing would be more convenient for Stragos than a wider outbreak of piracy near his city in the next few months.
Which is exactly why the brass sea captains have avoided going anywhere near Tal Varar for the last 7 years. We learned our lesson the bitter way. If he comes looking for a brawl, we'll duck and run before we'll grant him one.
I know, and so does he. Our job, our mandate, is to find some way to stir up trouble down here regardless. To get you to fly the red flag close enough for common Varari to see it from the public outhouses.
How the hell did you ever plan on accomplishing this?
I had some half-assed idea to spread rumors, offer bribes. If you hadn't hit the messenger, I would have tried to kindle a mess myself. But that was before we had any hint to the real state of things out here. Now Jerome and I obviously need your help.
To do what?
To buy time, to convince Stragos that we're succeeding on his behalf.
If you think for 1 second that I'll do anything to aid the Archon,
I don't. And if you think for 1 second that I truly mean to aid him, you haven't been listening. Stragos' antidote is supposedly good for 2 months. That means Jerome and I must be in Tal Varar in 5 weeks to get another sip. And if we have no progress to claim, he may simply decide to fold his investment in us.
If you have to leave us to return to Tal Varar, she said, that's unfortunate. But you can find an independent trader in Port Prodigal. They're never more than a few days apart. We have arrangements with a number of them that call in Tal Varar and Vel Verazzo. You'll have enough money from your shares to buy passage.
Samira, you have more wit than this. Listen,
I have spoken personally to Stragos several times. Been lectured is more the word, and I believe him. I believe that this is his last chance to put his foot down on the Priory and truly rule Tal Varar. He needs an enemy, Zamira. He needs an enemy that he knows he can crush. Then it would be madness to acquiesce to his plan by provoking him. Zamira, this fight is coming to you regardless of your intentions. You are all he has. You are the only foe that suits. He's already sacrificed a ship, a veteran sailing master, a galley crew's worth of prisoners, and a considerable amount of his own prestige just to put Jerome and me in play. As long as we're out here, as long as you're helping us, then you'll know exactly where his plans rest, because we'll be running them from your ship. If you ignore us, I have no idea what he'll try next. All I know is that he will have other designs, and you won't be privy to them. What good will it do me, said Zamira, to play along with you and rouse Tal Varar to the point that Stragos achieves his desire? We couldn't best his fleet 7 years ago with twice our present numbers. You're not the weapon, said Locke. Jerome and I are the weapons. We have access to Stragos. All we need is an answer to the poison, and we'll turn on the son of a bitch like a scorpion in his breech clout. For this I dangle my ship, my crew, and my children in easy reach of an enemy far beyond my strength? Zamira, you spoke of the Sea of Brass as though it were a fairy kingdom, infinitely mutable, but you are lashed tight to Port Prodigal, and you must know it. I don't doubt that you could sail for any port in the world and fetch it safely, but could you live anywhere else as you do here? Sell your goods and captured ships as easily? Pay your crew so regularly? Know the waters and your fellow outlaws so well? Lurk in trade lanes half as far from the navy of any great power? This is the strangest conversation I have had in years, said Zamira, returning her hat to her head, and probably the strangest request anyone has ever made of me. I have no way of knowing if anything you say is true, but I know this ship and how fast she can run if all else fails, even Port Prodigal. That is, of course, one option. Ignore me. Wait until Stragos finds some other way to have his war, or a likeness of a war, and then fly. To some other sea, some harder life. You said yourself you can't beat the Archon's navy. You can't strike at Stragos by force of arms. So consider this. Every other choice you have will sooner or later turn into withdrawal and retreat. Jerome and I represent the sole means of attack that you will ever possess. With your help, we could destroy the Arcanate forever. How? Oh, that's a sort of work in progress. Possibly the least reassuring thing you've... If nothing else, interrupted Locke, we know that there are powerful forces in Tal Varar balanced against the Archon. Jerome and I could contact them, involve them somehow. If the Arcanate were abolished, the Priory would hold Tal Varar by the purse strings. The last thing they'd want is embroilment in a useless war that might create another popular military hero. Standing here at the stern of my ship, weeks away from Tal Varar, how can you speak with any certainty of what can be done with that city's merchants and politicians? You said yourself that I had a talent for dishonesty. I often think it the only skill I have worthy of recommendation. But...
Drakasha, this is intolerable!
Locke and Zamira whirled, once again in unison, to find Scholar Tregann standing at the head of the companionway. She stepped toward them, limping without the support of her cane, and in her outthrust arms wriggled a chitinous black nightmare, multi-legged and gleaming in the lantern light, a spider the size of a cat. She held it belly outward, and its gleaming fangs twitched indignantly.
"Dear gods, it certainly is," said Locke.
"Tregann, what the hell is Zekasis doing out of her cage?"
"Your lieutenant has commenced an assault on the partition between our quarters," hissed Tregann. intolerable noise and commotion. She was lucky to shatter only one cage with all of her knocking about, and luckier still that I was there to restrain this blameless lady.
So, wait, you keep that thing in your quarters?
Locke was relieved to discover that it hadn't been prowling the ship, but only marginally so.
Where do you think wound silk comes from, Ravel? Quit flinching. Zacassis is a delicate and timid creature.
Tregan, said Drakasha, as a physicker you must be familiar with the courtship habits of the adult human female.
Yes, but 6 feet from my head is an insufferable intrusion.
Tregan, in my opinion, interrupting Ezri at the moment would be an insufferable intrusion. The quartermaster's compartment across the passage is open. Fetch the carpenter to give Zek temporary accommodations, and pitch your hammock in Gwilym's space.
I shall remember this indignity, Drakasha.
Yes, for approximately 10 minutes, until some new vexation arises to claim your full attention.
Should Del Mastro do herself some injury through her exertions, said Tregan primly, she may find another physicker to serve her needs, and I dare say that she may use her own abdomen to spin silk for her bandages.
I'm sure Isri's abdomen is otherwise occupied, scholar. Please find someone to build that thing a home for the night. You won't need to say much to convince them of your urgency.
As Tregan stomped off in a huff with her delicate and timid creature waving its legs in protest, Locke turned back to Zamira with one eyebrow raised.
Where did you ever...
The punishment for insolence to the Nikoran royal family is to be hung out to starve in an iron cage. We were in Nikora doing a bit of smuggling. Tregan was hanging there doing a bit of dying. Most of the time I don't regret cutting her down.
Well, what do you say to my...
mad proposal? Zamira, I don't need you to sail into Talvarar Harbour. Just give me something to buy another few months of Stragos indulgence. Sack a ship or two near Talvarar. Quick and easy work. You know Jerome and I will be the first over the side for you. Just let them run for the city and spread a bit of panic. Then send us in one night by boat. Let us do our business, and we'll be back with a better idea of how to turn the situation.
Attack ships flying the Varari flag, then get close enough to the city to let you slip in by boat? Wait at anchor with a 5,000 solari bounty on my head?
Now that is an injustice, Samira, whatever else I've done to merit suspicion. If Jerome and I merely wanted to slip back to Talvarar, why would we have risked our necks in your attack this morning? And if I wanted to continue deceiving you or spying on you, why didn't I just play along with your conclusion that we were agents of the Priori?
Jerome and I quarreled this morning. If you spoke to Jibril before you pulled me out of your hold, you must know that I'm a divine of the 13th, the Crooked Warden. You're our people, more or less, our kind. It's a matter of propriety. Jerome insisted that we tell you the truth, that we needed you as willing allies and not as dupes. I'm ashamed to say that I was too angry to agree. But he was right, and it's not just fucking sentiment, it's hard truth. I don't think Jerome and I can pull this off unless you aid us with full knowledge of what we're up to. And if you can't or won't do that, I think you've got a hell of a mess coming your way. Soon.
Drakasha settled her right hand on the pommel of one of her sabers and closed her eyes, looking tired and vexed.
Before anything else, she said at last, apart from all other considerations, we need to put in at Port Prodigal. I have cargo to sell, stores to buy, a prize to dispose of, and crew to meet up with. We're several days out, and will be several days there. I will think on what you've said. One way or another, I'll give you an answer after we've done our business there.
Thank you.
So it's Leocanto, then?
Just keep calling me Ravel, said Locke. Easier for everyone.
So be it.
You're on the merry watch, and you won't be shifted back to duty watches until tomorrow afternoon. I suggest you make good use of the night.
Well, Locke glanced down at his leather cup of blue wine, suddenly thinking that maybe he could do with a few more, and perhaps a dice game to lose himself in for a few hours. If the gods are kind, I already have. Good night, Captain Drakasha.
He left her alone at the taffrail, silently studying the monster that lurked in the orchid's wake.
8.
Did that hurt?
Whispered Ezri, tracing a finger across the sweat-slick skin above Jean's ribs.
Did it hurt? Gods above, woman, no. That was...
I don't mean that.
She gave him a firm poke in the scar that arced across his abdomen beneath his right breast.
That!
Oh, that. No, it was wonderful. Someone came after me with a pair of thieves' teeth. Felt like a warm breeze on a fine spring day. I loved every second of...
Oof! Ass!
Where did you get such sharp elbows? You grind those things against a whetstone, or... Oof!
Ezri lay on top of Jean on the demi-silk hammock that took up most of the space in her compartment. It was just barely long enough for him to lie with one arm above his head, brushing the interior bulkhead of the ship's starboard side, and he could have spanned its width between his outstretched arms. An alchemical trinket the size of a coin provided a faint silver light. Ezri's witchwood dark curls were touched with fey highlights. Scattered strands gleamed like threads of spider silk in moonlight. He ran his hands through that damp forest of hair, massaged her warm scalp with his fingernails, and she let her muscles go slack with a gratifying moan of relaxation. The motionless air in the compartment was thick with sweat and the trapped heat of their first endless, frantic hour together. The place was also, Jean noticed for the first time, utterly wrecked. Their clothes were scattered in purest chaos. Ezri's weapons and few possessions littered the deck like navigational hazards. A small net containing a few books and scrolls hung from a ceiling beam and tilted toward the compartment door, indicating that the whole ship was heeled over to larboard.
Ezri, he muttered, staring at the stiffened canvas partition that formed their left-hand wall. A pair of large feet and a pair of small feet had given it a serious denting.
Ezri, whose cabin did we nearly kick our way into a little while ago? Oh, Scholar Tregan's. Who told you to stop doing that to my hair? Oh, much better.
Will she be pissed off?
More so than usual? Ezri yawned and shrugged. She's free to find a lover of her own and kick it back whenever she pleases. I'm too preoccupied to be diplomatic.
She kissed Jean's neck, and he shivered.
Besides, night hasn't nearly run its course yet. We may kick the whole damn thing down if I have my way, Jerome.
Then it's your way we'll have,
said Jean, gently shifting the weight of her body until they were lying on their sides, face to face. He ran his hands as carefully as he could over the stiff bandages on her upper arms, the only thing she couldn't in good sense take off. His hands moved to her cheeks, and then to her hair. They kissed for the sort of endless moment that only exists between lovers whose lips are still new territory to each other.
"Jerome," she whispered.
"No. Do something for me, Ezri. In private. Never call me that."
"Why not?"
"Call me my real name."
He kissed her neck, put his lips to one of her ears, and whispered into it.
"Jean,"
she repeated.
"Gods, yes. Say that again."
"Jean Estevan Tannen. I like that."
"Yours and yours alone," Jean whispered.
"Something in return," she said. "Ezrian d'Astiri de la Mastron, Dame Ezrian of the House of Mastron, Nicora."
"Really? You have an estate or something?"
"Doubt it. Spare daughters who run away from home don't tend to receive holdings.
She kissed him again, then ruffled his beard with her fingertips. In fact, with the letter I left mother and father, I'm sure I was disinherited at the best possible speed.
Gods, I'm sorry.
Don't be. She moved her fingers down to his chest. These things happen. You keep moving. You find things here and there that help you forget.
You do indeed,
he whispered, and then they were too busy to talk for a good long while. 9. Locke was pulled out of his vivid thicket of dreams by a number of things. The rising heat of day, the pressure of 3 cups of wine in his bowels, the moans of the hungover men around him, and the sharp prick of claws from the heavy little creature sleeping on the back of his neck. Struck by a sudden foggy memory of Scholar Tregan's spider, he gasped in horror and rolled over, clutching at whatever was clinging to him. He blinked several times to clear the veil of slumber from his eyes, and found himself struggling not with a spider but with a kitten, narrow-faced and black-furred.
"The hell?" Locke muttered.
"Mew,"
the kitten retorted, locking gazes with him. It had the expression common to all kittens, that of a tyrant in the becoming. "I was comfortable, and you dared to move," those jade eyes said. "For that you must die." When it became apparent to the cat that its 2 or 3 pounds of mass were insufficient to break Locke's neck with one mighty snap, it put its paws on his shoulders and began sharing its drool-covered nose with his lips. He recoiled.
"That's regal," said someone to Locke's left.
"Regal? No, it's ridiculous." Locke tucked the kitten under his arm like a dangerous alchemical device. Its fur was thin and silky, and it began to purr noisily. The man who'd spoken was Jabril. Locke raised his eyebrows when he saw that